This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Dr. Kevin Fong, author of the new book Extreme Medicine. It's about what doctors have learned from treating patients that have been exposed to extreme cold, heat, trauma, the gravity-free environment of space, and the pressure of the deep sea. Kevin Fong is an anesthesiologist who's also trained in intensive care medicine. He's the founder of the Center for Altitude, Space, and Extreme Environment Medicine at the University College London, where he's also a senior lecturer in physiology. He spoke with Terry earlier this week.
Dr. Kevin Fong, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with space medicine. What are some of the most typical health problems that astronauts who are spending time in space experience?
Well, you know, it's funny because when you see spacemen and women on television, you get this impression that it's sort of like a slightly more fun version of a super long-haul passenger flight, that, you know, it's quite a comfortable experience and they're just floating around there having quite a lot of fun while engaged in quite a serious task. But when you look down into it, you realize that these expeditions are true expeditions really in the same sense that walking into the deserts or climbing our highest mountains or, you know, exploring our polar regions are, that you know, you go into this environment and it's the same, you learn the same lessons from it that you learn everywhere else in exploration, and that is that we can exist there, but not forever and not without penalty. And they experience everything from a wasting of their bones, wasting of their muscles, wasting really a deconditioning of their heart because their heart itself is a muscle pump. All of this because of the lack of gravitational load, the lack of the force of gravity upon their bodies. And then there's some stuff that you wouldn't really readily predict. They have problems with their hand-eye coordination. It seems that the apparatus in your inner ear that detects accelerations, that helps you with your day-to-day hand-eye coordination, also gets pretty messed up there. And so they have problems tracking moving objects with their eyes. And also on top of that, they feel pretty sick. And in fact, most rookie astronauts feel sick or are sick in the first 24 to 48 hours of flight. So when you see them up there on camera waving and smiling at you, you have to know that underneath that is a lot of discomfort for lots of them.
You tell this great story, something that happened to you in your chapter about underwater medicine. And you were trained in escape training underwater. This is the Royal Navy's helicopter underwater escape training facility. And the goal here was to teach you how to escape from a helicopter that has crashed in the ocean. You're submerged and you have to get out. And there's some amazing things about what happens to the body underwater and why everything that you have to do is totally counterintuitive if your helicopter's crashed. So can you talk about that negative buoyancy?
Yeah, so, you know, most of our experience of the water and all the ocean is limited to a couple of meters, you know, from the surface. And so we feel this sensation that the water wants to throw us back out. You know, it's hard, it takes effort to dive below the surface, doesn't it? And very few of us really dive to any depth at which that relationship changes. But what happens is, as you dive into the water around you starts to compress the tissues of your body so that you yourself become more dense. And after you've gone maybe only, depending on your build and what you're wearing, but maybe 7-8 meters from the surface, so, you know, a very modest distance, you are no longer buoyant. That is, you will no longer float. You're more likely to sink than float. And so after that point, you become negatively buoyant, which is to say that you sink. So the problem is, if you're in a vehicle that has crashed or is sinking, and you are more than you know, a few meters, a handful of meters under the surface, you're going to be more likely to sink than float. And this causes huge problems if you're in a vehicle and there is no source of illumination. So if you're in there at night, and you have this horrific realization that if you find yourself below about 10 meters at night with no light to show you the way, you're not going to have an idea of which way to swim, and you're just going to have to choose a direction. And if you choose the wrong direction, you're going to swim for the rest of your life, I mean, quite literally.
So you describe, you're in a test facility in basically a large warm pool, a very large warm pool.
Yeah, it was at the time.
And you're in this like submerged helicopter learning how to escape. This is like a training experience for if this happens in the ocean.
In this training operation, they put you in this thing that looks pretty much exactly like the sorts of helicopters they may take you from the shore to an oil rig in. And you're strapped in with in my case, I think it was a 5-point harness. And then you go into the water. And so the first thing that you think that you would do if you're in a vehicle that is sinking and the water's pouring in the windows is, well, you'd unstrap from your seat and you'd try and get out. But the problem with that is you've got such a current of water coming in through all the openings that if you do that, you're just going to get washed around inside this vehicle as the vehicle itself turns over and starts sinking, and you're going to get disorientated, you're going to get lost inside this vehicle, you're probably never going to make it out because you'll never find your way to an exit. So counterintuitively, what you're supposed to do is to sit there and have the presence of mind to put one hand on the buckle of your seat belt, so you know how to undo that, and the other hand on an exit, preferably on the handle that's going to eject the window that you're going to swim out of. And then you're meant to wait, and I think the phrase they use is to wait for all violent motion to cease, which is basically them saying wait until you're really sinking and everything's stopped moving. And then once that's happened, then you're meant to eject the window, hold on to the window frame, and then pull your seat buckle apart and pull yourself out of the window. It takes quite a lot of discipline to resist that urge just to get the hell out of there from the word go, and that becomes the difference between life and death in that situation.
How did your body and your mind fight each other when your body was saying get me out of here and your mind was saying no, I have to sit still, I have to wait till it turns upside down, I have to wait till I'm totally immersed in water?
Yeah, well, you know, it is completely, if no one had told you what to do, you would have done completely the opposite. You would have unbuckled from your belt the minute that you saw the water coming in the sides, and I think that would have been the end of you. I mean, they show you very graphically that is not the right thing to do. And so what you realize is that in those situations, your life depends on a sequence of fairly simple, massively counterintuitive steps that protect you from yourself, really, in that situation. And so the key to it is just listening to what your instructor is telling you and to believe, to have faith in them that's the right thing to do. And once you do that, once you get used to that, once you can overcome your overwhelming sort of panic response to think, well, surely the less time I'm in this vehicle, the better, then everything's okay and it's actually almost calm. But they do show you, beforehand, they show you videos of sort of these young, they're young airmen from the Royal Air Force or indeed from other branch of the armed services who haven't listened, and the thing goes in, the thing goes upside down, they unbuckle, they get lost, and they find themselves swimming around in the dark, unable to find their way out before an instructor hauls them out, very heavily through the windows. So you don't want to do that.
So when you finally, at that last minute, pull the release and undo your safety belt, how do you know which way to swim?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, if it's daylight and there's still some light around, you're supposed to watch for bubbles and watch the bubbles rising and follow the bubbles. If it's nighttime, you hope that it's a clear night and you might see some illumination, moonlight perhaps through the surface. But it is possible that it is a deep, dark, black night and you're swimming out into the inky blackness and you just don't know and you're just going to have to choose a direction. And there are accounts of these sort of accounts from sailors with these terrifying stories of them swimming out into the inky blackness, not knowing, and swimming and swimming and just hoping that they've chosen the right way and hoping that it's going to take them up to the surface.
One of the chapters in your new book is about what happens to the body in frigid, in just like extreme cold. So you juxtapose two stories. One is the story of what happened to Robert Falcon Scott, an explorer who froze to death in Antarctica in 1912. with the survival of a 29-year-old woman who was under the ice in frozen water for 80 minutes before she was even rescued and her heart had stopped beating. It's an incredible story. But let's just start. Let's start in Antarctica. What happens to the body? What happened to Robert Falcon Scott's body when he froze to death?
So Falcon Scott's expedition, so in 1912, he takes his polar party of five men to the South Pole. And the reason I was interested in that story was because, you know, it shows you how far we've come in a very short space of time. You know, at the start of the 20th century, the maps of the world still had white space, space where no human foot had ever trodden, and that included the South Polar region and the summit of our highest mountains and our deepest oceans, let alone the endless skies. So Scott's out there in 1912, walking back from the South Pole, having failed to win the race to the pole. That race has been won by the Norwegian team led by Roald Amundsen. And they run into trouble. They run into a huge storm. And he, with the remaining three surviving members of the expedition party, find themselves in a tent, freezing to death. So within each cell are these little organelles called mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell. They are the sources of power of our life, really. And they're like biological batteries. And they work very, very crudely by separating charge across membranes, really like an electrical battery does, you know, the sort you'd put in your flashlight. And so as Scott gets colder and colder, those biological batteries start to run down, and he can no longer maintain this disequilibrium with the environment around him. He can no longer be this blazing furnace of life. And so, finally and inexorably, he becomes like the wasteland around him, just no more energetic than the physical landscape in which he is, and freezes to death.
And another thing that's happening to the body as the body is freezing is that the blood vessels are constricting. Why are they constricting, and what impact does that have on the body?
So just before you freeze to death, you mount this sort of, you know, final effort to try and save your life. And so you try and centralize the heat to the core of your body. Your blood vessels constrict to try and stop you losing, you know, heat from your periphery, from your arms and from your legs. And then you try and get your hairs to stand on end. Well, you do. It's one of the reflexes we have. So your hair stands on end, trying to trap an extra layer of air to insulate your body. But, you know, all of this is your body sort of mounting its last ditch attempts to keep itself alive. It does everything it can. It shivers hard to try and generate extra heat. It gets your hair standing up on end, trying to trap that layer of heat. But all of this is really, you know, in the supposition that you can do something to change your environment to stop this process continuing. It's to buy you a bit of extra time. But in the case of Scott in that tent in 1912, there is no time to be bought. There is no rescue. And so all of those efforts to keep him alive are kind of in vain.
So let's compare this to an incident in 1999 where a woman nearly froze to death and amazingly didn't. Two women and a man are skiing in Norway. A 29-year-old woman on the ski trail falls through the ice over a stream. She falls into the freezing water. She's trapped there for 80 minutes until people come and pull her out. And then she first has to get to some kind of, you know, medical situation. Her heart had stopped beating. She didn't have a pulse. How is her body able to survive, considering can't you say she was technically dead?
Well, I mean, certainly she was at the state at which she was, she'd be indistinguishable really from someone who was dead. Her heart wasn't beating, she wasn't breathing, she was blue, cold and lifeless, and you would have had to look extraordinarily hard to find any signs that she was alive at all. But incredibly, despite the fact that her heart stopped for perhaps nearly 3 hours, she was resuscitated successfully. And this, then, is the story of Anna Bagenholm, who is a remarkable, remarkable woman. So she was a junior doctor in 1999, I think about 29 years old, with two of her friends skiing in the northern mountains of Norway, so up in the Arctic Circle. And I think it was one of the first days of eternal sunshine at the start of the Arctic summer. And she catches an edge on her ski, goes headlong into a hole in some ice covering a stream and into that water. And they take a long time to get her out of there. And they know because all of them are doctors, they know what's at stake here. They know that she'll freeze to death if they leave her in that position. But there is no one around to help them. The ski patrol are over an hour over the other side of the mountain. The nearest helicopter rescue is over an hour away flying time. And by the time they get her out of that ice, and I've spoken to her boyfriend, who's one of the party, you know, when they retrieve her from the ice, they said she's blue and she's lifeless. And at that point, they thought all they were going to achieve there was to retrieve the body of a dead friend. Nevertheless, they started to resuscitate her, and they resuscitate her and continue resuscitating until the helicopter arrives. Now, the helicopter can't land, so it throws down a winch, and they take her aboard the helicopter. And this is maybe an hour after her heart has first stopped. On the helicopter now, they continue to resuscitate her, even though it's another hour's flight back to Tromsø, which is the nearest major hospital in that region. And so when they arrive through the front doors of that hospital, her heart has not beaten for the best part of 2 hours, maybe 2 hours, actually. And that's to a clinician, to a doctor, that's an incredible thing to hear, that you have someone who arrives and you're being told that her heart hasn't beaten for, you know, maybe 2 hours, and that question that you ask is it worth us trying to resuscitate her here? And you know, in clinical practice, for me, when that happens, when you're called to see someone who's in cardiac arrest, whose heart has stopped, almost the first thing you ask is, well, how long has it been? How long has it been since that heart stopped? And if someone tells you it's been more than about half an hour, you're pretty pessimistic about your chances of getting someone back alive. And yet for her, she's been down now for 2 hours, and they still decide to proceed, which is, I don't know if heroic is the right word, but it's an incredible decision that they're hoping. They have one last hope, and that is that the thing that has stopped her heart, the thing that is killing her, has also protected her, has protected her brain from the starvation of oxygen that it suffered. And they know that this is possible. They know that for people who come in at very low temperatures, there is a chance of resuscitating them even after extended periods of time if they've been cold enough. Now,
why is that? Is the refrigeration of your body kind of keeping it fresh in a way, in the way that it would food?
So that's right. So the cold, the hypothermia, is a double-edged sword here, because it conspires to run the batteries of life down, really, in a way, and that's what stops your heart. It's, you know, that's what leads to the cardiac arrest. But also, it protects the brain. So although it kills you, it smears out the dying process. And death, you know, we think of death as being a moment in time, but actually it is a process. And that process is usually, you know, relatively quick. It's completed in a few minutes under normal conditions. But here with these extremes of cold, you know, and her core temperature is 13.7 degrees Celsius, I think, when she arrives. So, you know, our normal core body temperature now is 37 degrees, both of us. It's within plus or minus about 0.2 degrees of that. So her core temperature is incredibly low. And what that does biologically is it takes the process of death and it smears it out over seconds and extends it to minutes. And in her case, they hope that it has smeared it out to be hours long enough that they might intervene, restore the supply of oxygen to her brain, start her heart again, and get someone back who resembles the person she was before the accident.
in the head to warm her blood and warm her body. Would you explain how they did that?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's a fascinating part of the story, really, because, you know, when we get someone into our ER rooms who needs resuscitating, you know, you stick them on the gurney and you get to work in the resuscitation bays. But they had the presence of mind to know that that wasn't going to be enough. They knew that they needed to rewarm her very quickly if they were to have any chance. And so they took her past the ER straight up to the operating theatres, and they plugged her into a heart-lung bypass machine, the sort of machine that you would use to do open-heart surgery. And they do that because they know that, you know, there's no point in sticking warmed blankets on top of her or giving her warmed fluids. That's not going to be enough. They need to raise her whole body, you know, I guess 50 to 60-odd kilograms of body up through you know, about 20 degrees Celsius of temperature. And to do that, they're going to have to remove the blood from her body with this bypass machine and warm it up outside the body, inside this machine, and then send that back into her body in the hope that that can resuscitate her. And so that's what they do. They do, effectively, they do a bit of bypass surgery on her. They plug tubes into her great veins and her major arteries and recirculate her blood out of her body into a machine that's capable of warming up very quickly. And 3 hours after her heart had first stopped, it begins to beat again for the first time.
And after a very long period of several years worth of, you know, slow recovery and physical rehab, she's skiing again and working at this hospital that saved her life.
She's truly remarkable. And I've come to know Anna quite well. And indeed, you know, if you were talking to her now, you would have no sense of the ordeal that she's been through. She is an incredibly robust and impressive individual. And she feels it's her duty to tell this story because she thinks that, particularly to other clinicians, to other doctors, because she says, you know, it's an example of where the limits lie. She feels that people should know, should have the courage to try in these situations and not just be fatalistic about what the outcome would be. Because, you know, there are many people who wouldn't have tried as hard in that situation. There are many people who would have given up much sooner than this team did. And yet they continued. And today you have a woman who is a fully qualified doctor who is out there, you know, doing her job.
Kevin Fong is the author of Extreme Medicine, How Exploration Transformed Medicine in the 20th Century. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. The band Lake Street Dive is a quartet that began performing together almost a decade ago when its members were students at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. Recently, the group attracted attention when they were invited by T-Bone Burnett to perform at a New York Town Hall concert featuring music from and inspired by the Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Lake Street Dive's debut album called Bad Self-Portraits.
Lake Street Dive is powered by the voice of Rachel Price. It's what hits you first when you listen to this quartet. It's a ringingly clear, strong voice, a sound that's at once beseeching and in control. Price regularly harmonizes with the other members of the group, bassist Bridget Kearney, drummer Mike Calabrese, and Mike Olson, who also plays guitar and trumpet. But most of the songs on Bad Self-Portraits are showcases for Price's surging vocals.
Would it be true to say that I ordered you? Or is it you?
You Go Down Smooth, a song that provoked cheers when Lake Street Dive performed it amidst all the big stars T-Bone Burnett had gathered for his Inside Llewyn Davis tribute concert. The song, like much of Lake Street Dive's material, looks to the past. In this case, a driving pop soul 60s sound. One thing that raised Lake Street Dive's profile was a YouTube video of the group performing the Jackson 5's I Want You Back on a Boston street. It's racked up more than a million views, popular for the way it not only displays the group's talent, but frames it as something both spontaneous and studied, a throwback to doo-wop groups crooning on street corners. This is the kind of thing that plays to the least interesting thing about Lake Street Dive, the privileging of technique over originality, the domestication of music that once was more unruly. You can sometimes hear this on Lake Street's original material, on a song such as Rabid Animal, which is catchy but hardly embodies the fervid intensity implied by rabidness. Price also has a career as a jazz vocalist, performing with musicians such as Joshua Redman and T.S. Monk. And she's released solo albums that include interpretations of standards like Skylark and Serenade in Blue. There's a mood to this music that Lake Street Dive occasionally captures on a song such as Bridget Kearney's composition, Better Than.
I could spend ages reading the spend days singing the blues, but I turn up the TV light, give up without a fight. Better than pretending to know what's wrong or what's right. I could spend ages.
When you look at YouTube videos of Lake Street performing covers such as the Mamas and the Papas version of Dedicated to the One I Love, what you get is not a fresh interpretation of a song initially made famous by the Five Royales and the Shirelles, but rather a very nice Mamas and the Papas impersonation. But enough times on this album to make it worth your while, Lake Street Dive powers past nicety to connect with the passion that brings blood and sweat to the tears that heartache songs need in order to thrive.
Ken Tucker reviewed Bad Self-Portraits, the debut album from the band Lake Street Dive. After a quick break, we'll hear Terry's interview with Kayla Williams and Brian McGuff, a married couple who met while serving in Iraq. How their marriage survived the aftermath of the Iraq War is the subject of Williams' new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Kayla Williams and Brian McGuff, a married couple who met while serving in the Army during the Iraq War. They've had to work hard to keep their marriage together. Each has suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and Brian McGuff is still recovering from a brain injury he sustained when an IED went off next to a bus he was riding in. McGuff's brain was penetrated by shrapnel, leaving him with physical and cognitive problems he's still recovering from, as well as periods of depression, rage, and paranoia. Williams and McGuff met before the injury, but didn't start seeing each other until after. They married in 2005, just days before Williams' book tour promoting her memoir, Love My Rifle More Than You, about being a young woman in the Army serving in Iraq. Kayla Williams has written a new memoir about her relationship with her husband. It's called Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War.
Kayla Williams, Brian McGough, welcome to Fresh Air. This is a very kind of dramatic, difficult place to start, but I think it's the right place to start. I'd like you to describe what happened to Brian. Brian, do you want to describe what you know of what happened when you were injured?
Sure. We were riding on a bus back from the airport in Mosul, Iraq, and an IED went off next to the bus. Took shrapnel to the back of my head, went through the front. I was medevaced to Baghdad where they did surgery on me, and then I was medevaced to Germany where I started my recovery. And from there, I went to Walter Reed and spent 2 years there recovering from my injury.
What was the status of your relationship then? How well did you know each other?
We didn't know each other very well. We had met on the side of a mountain, kind of teased each other, joked around. The military can be kind of a rough place. It's not very tender. We couldn't go out on any dates. But I knew I was interested in him and attracted to him. And one night I had confessed to him that I really wanted to get to know him better. And he said, there's plenty of time for that when we come home.
I was playing hard to get.
And I should say that's where the title of your book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, comes from.
Right.
So, Kayla, when you returned to the States and saw Brian again, how did he seem changed from his injuries?
When I first got back from Iraq and saw Brian again, I didn't notice or recognize the changes. And it was also this honeymoon period where he was so happy to still be alive that things seemed to be going pretty well. And we just hung out, spent a lot of time together. I was still so discombobulated by returning that I didn't really understand what was going on either, and I didn't have to go to work. I was on block leave. So we both would just sit around and get drunk and hang out and have fun. It wasn't until I had to go back on duty and show up and do PT every morning at 6:30 and work all day and then come home that I started to really realize how badly things were going for him and recognize how things were falling apart when I had a structure to go back to and he didn't.
And at that point, how could you see that he had changed? What kind of like cognitive or physical problems did you notice that he was having?
He wasn't paying his bills. He would get notices that his electricity was about to be shut off or his water was about to be shut off because when he would get a paycheck, he would spend it all within 3 or 4 days. The executive functioning portion of his brain had been damaged, and so he would just buy a new computer and buy rounds of beers for everybody at the bar, and his entire paycheck would be gone within days. And he was a staff sergeant. He was a leader who was used to planning and executing multi-day missions, supporting multiple troops in a combat zone. So for him to go from being able to handle that level of responsibility to suddenly not being able to even pay his own bills, I knew something was wrong.
Ryan, to help us understand the extent of the brain injury that you had, would one of you describe what actually happened in your brain physically?
Sure. I can go ahead and talk about what the doctor told us. So essentially a piece of shrapnel went through the back of my head, burrowed the skull from the back of my head past my ear out through where my eye is. And while doing this, it also kind of ripped some brain matter out. I think there's probably some pictures in the book if anybody wants to see them.
The publisher would not include them because they were too graphic. But I did put them on the book's Facebook page if you want to see a picture of Brian's brain.
So you didn't see the physical, you didn't see the images of what happened in his brain until recently.
Yeah.
But you had seen some of the ways that he changed, including
right. The
insomnia, the drinking, really terrible mood swings. And the bad mood swings were really bad.
And some of it I couldn't untangle what was physiological or cognitive and what was psychological. So he also developed pretty severe post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. And those the brain injury and the PTSD and the depression are all kind of tangled up together and really difficult to unwind. So if you have insomnia because you have PTSD, not sleeping impairs your cognitive function. And if you have more impaired cognitive function and you realize you can't do what you used to be able to do, it's really depressing and affects your mood. And then you behave worse and it affects your relationships and that makes you angrier. And so it was like every bad thing fed on every other bad thing in this downward spiral that just was extraordinarily difficult to eventually pull out of.
And add to that that you didn't really know each other very well. So you probably also didn't know like what is like the deepest part of his character and what is a symptom of trauma.
Right. My friends thought I was crazy.
Crazy for?
Staying.
With him?
Yes.
But did you ask yourself that?
People ask me all the time.
Did you ask yourself that if you wanted to continue a relationship with him, knowing that his injuries might cause permanent cognitive and physical deficits, knowing that some of those problems included, you know, dangerous mood swings where he became a danger to you and maybe to himself?
At the very beginning, I think I didn't understand. And then I fell in love with him. And by the time I started to understand what it really meant, I was already pretty deeply in. But there were a lot of times that I contemplated running away from it. I realized way later that I was doing things to bind myself to him to make it harder to run away if I got freaked out or scared and wanted to leave. So getting married and then buying a house together, these were things that I was doing to make it harder to run away when things got hard, because there were some really hard times. But I had this faith that we would be able to pull through, and I just kept convincing myself that he would get better. I didn't have any evidence on which to hang that hope, but through luck or perseverance or some combination of things, that did turn out to be the case. But it was a rough and very, very rough road to get to where we are today.
This might be a little difficult to talk about, but Kayla, one of the things you write about in your memoir, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, is about your husband Brian's mood swings, which would sometimes turn violent against you. And I want you to describe an example of that, something that he started calling code black, because you asked him, like, give me some warning that this is coming on, if you could feel it coming on. And so he would say code black. Give us an example of that.
Yeah, if he knew it was coming, he would say code black and just not talk to me for a few days until it would pass. I could always tell that it was going to get ugly when first he would switch from drinking just beer to drinking hard liquor, doing shots. That was an indicator that things might go bad. And then the clue always was when his face would just flatten. It was like the shades being pulled. He would go from having a more expressive face to just complete coldness. And he would say, "You don't understand. You'll never understand." And that was when I knew that some switch had flipped in his head and he had crossed over into a level of rage or something that he couldn't control anymore. We'd had a lot of terrible arguments when he was in these code black moments. And I'd say the very, very worst incident was when once it happened and I for some reason, I snapped and thought, I can't live like this anymore. I'd locked myself in the bedroom and he was throwing himself at the door. And I thought, I can't go on like this. I can't imagine trying to live the rest of my life not knowing when this moment will happen, not knowing if it's going to be safe, thinking I can't have children because I don't know if one of these rages will happen. And I decided that rather than go on, I would rather be dead. And I asked him to kill me. And he put a gun to my head and pulled the trigger. And it was not loaded. And he threw the gun away and called me crazy. And I left. And that night was the lowest point in our relationship. And it ended up being the turning point in our relationship, because the next day I fell rock climbing with a friend trying to stay focused and have some social interaction and pretend my life wasn't horrible. I fell and broke my ankle and ended up in a cast and was helpless and totally dependent on Brian. And that changed the dynamic in our relationship, put him in a position of being able to care for me, put me in a position of needing to rely on him. And that started a shift in how we interacted with each other and enabled him to really begin the healing process that has gotten to where it is today.
Let me take a step back. I want to get back to when you asked your husband to kill you, to take his gun and pull the trigger, and he took his gun and pulled the trigger, but the gun wasn't loaded. Brian, when you did that, did you know it wasn't loaded?
Yes, but it still was a stupid move, not one that I would recommend to anyone.
Why did you go that far?
You have to kind of get in the frame of mind that in my mind, and I can't control this, and I have to kind of fight with this every day, every small, slight, or minor transgression is amplified by anywhere from like 10 to 20. So, for instance, if you cut me off in traffic, that is almost like if somebody were to ram into your car to you. That's how my brain responds to things. It amps things up. So when I was put in that situation, my brain kind of took over and just went to work in a way that shouldn't have happened. And there was, alcohol involved and a lot of emotions. And, it was something we're very fortunate that nothing bad happened, nothing worse happened. And, it worked out the way it did, but very lucky for both of us.
Can I ask you a horrible question? If the gun was loaded, would you have put it to her head and pulled the trigger?
No.
Good. You're the parents of two young children now. And Brian, you had said earlier that crisis mode, since your injury, like crisis mode is where you feel like you perform the best and feel most relaxed. I think young children could keep you in a pretty fairly constant state of crisis mode. And I'm wondering what the experience for you has been like being a father during this period of ongoing recovery from the IED explosion that left you with traumatic brain injury and all the post-traumatic stress that accompanied that.
Sure. So it's kind of important to keep in mind that I've been a father for quite a while, a daughter born in 1998. So I came into this new fatherhood with a little bit of experience.
Right, I should say that was with your first marriage before you and Kayla were together.
Exactly. So I had a little bit of experience. There are difficult times, but it's easy for me to kind of separate that, they're kids and they're kids. And, I've never had an issue with them pushing me over the edge or anything. They're trying, but they're no more trying than any other kids. I get frustrated. I don't think I get frustrated more than any other parent out there. But it's definitely a lot of work. And it does keep me in crisis mode when someone's screaming at 3 o'clock in the morning and there's, vomit all over the bed and all those fun things.
Brian, you've described how easy it is for you to go into a rage and how you things are often a little exaggerated in your mind. Everything's a little amped up. What about joy and pleasure? Is it hard for you to experience joy and pleasure? And are those sensations amplified too?
No, they're not amplified. So it is very difficult for me to experience those. I still do experience them, but it's not the same. And most of the joy and pleasure that I get comes from that amped up kind of high adrenaline, situations like when the kids were born, when I was in the fire department, running calls. And I still get pleasure from doing things like going out with Kayla or doing things with the kids, but it's not elevated.
It's like living with Eeyore. And I think he thinks it's probably like living with Tigger. You know, I'll say like, oh, do you want to go to the beach? Let's go to the beach. It's going to be so fun. Let's go. It'll be great. It'll be great. And he's like, if it doesn't rain, it might be okay.
If the surf's good.
Yeah, but it'll probably, the surf will probably be bad. And then everybody will be sandy. It'll be gross. Like, really?
And Kayla, do you feel out of sync with that? I mean, is your like, is your interest in pleasure, your ability to experience it, you know, do you experience pleasure more easily and do you feel out of sync?
Yes, I do feel out of sync quite often. He calls me a hyper little chihuahua sometimes because I'm bouncing around like, let's go do stuff. It'll be great. It'll be great. And he doesn't have that same reaction to things. And it can be really hard to live with somebody who doesn't match that same level. And I'm sure it's frustrating for him. But yeah, it can be frustrating for me too. And other times I just have to tell myself, like, he doesn't have to act as excited. He just has to show up. And maybe he'll enjoy it once he gets there. Or he doesn't have to be smiling while we do something. He can take his own level of pleasure in it, and that's okay. But yeah, I do. I'd say feeling out of sync is a good way to put it.
Even I feel out of sync with it. So I mean, I know that there are things that happen that should make me happier, and they don't, and that's something that it's very difficult to deal with. But I am kind of like Eeyore.
So appreciate you sharing your story, and I wish you good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for giving us a chance to tell our story.
Thanks. It was our pleasure.
Brian McGuff and Kayla Williams speaking with Terry Gross. Williams' new memoir is called Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.